It's time for From the Short Grass with Trey Schaap, a golf podcast for those who love golf, struggle with golf, and just like to enjoy the outdoors and fellowship with friends, all while chasing a ball around trying to put it in a 4 1/4 inch diameter hole. From the Short Grass is brought to you by Stevens Incorporated, an independent financial services firm with the freedom to focus on what matters most. Blackman Auctions. For over 80 years, better auctions have always been Blackman Auctions. Beachwood Pinnacle Hotels. We partner with you to deliver high-yield results by managing, developing, and investing in top-quality hospitality assets. And now, from the Short Grass, here is your host, Trey Schaap.
Welcome to another edition of From the Short Grass. I am your host, Trey Schaap. It's a big week on the PGA Tour. The FedEx Cup playoffs begin. The FedEx St. Jude Championship takes place at TPC Southwind in Memphis, Tennessee. Good luck to all of those competing. And in a couple of weeks, we will know who this year's FedEx Cup champion will be. We're going to do things a little bit different on this episode of From the Short Grass. We're going to actually do the interview on a golf course while a tournament is going on. The Arkansas State Golf Association held their match play championships a little over a week ago at Burns Park Golf Course in North Little Rock. I sat down with Randy Reed, who is a volunteer rules official, and he helps with course setup. Randy is no stranger to the game of golf and no stranger to the rules of golf as well, and I think you're going to enjoy my sit down with him from the golf course. Before we get to that, I want to tell you about one of our great sponsors, Blackman Auctions. Since 1938, better auctions have always been Blackman Auctions. Find them on the web, blackmanauctions.com. You never know what you might find at an auction, so I encourage you to go to their website, search their upcoming auctions. If you see one you might be interested in, go. That's all you have to do. Blackman Auctions, a great sponsor of From the Short Grass.
Traveling to Fayetteville to watch a game? Forgot to book a room for the night? Beachwood Pinnacle Hotel Group has you covered. Stay where the fans stay. Stayridge Suites is just south of Baum Walker Stadium and is an all-suite hotel within walking distance of Baum Walker, Bud Walton, and Razorback Stadium. Or you could stay at the Comfort Inn and Suites with newly remodeled rooms throughout the entire property. Find them on the web at bphotels.com. Beachwood Pinnacle Hotels.
This is Thomas Blackman with Blackman Auctions. The economy is changing slowly but surely. The market is slowing down in a gradual slide. Not an emergency yet, the sky is not falling, but a change is coming. When times are good, auctions make buyers compete to buy at the highest market value. When the economy gets tough, auctions force buyers to make a purchase decision. Either way, auctions get the highest return for a seller and a strong deal for a buyer. With an experienced auction company, it's a simple process. Go to blackmanauctions.com for more information. Since 1938, better auctions are Blackman Auctions.
At Stevens, our philosophy is to invest every dollar as if it were our own. To seize opportunity. To anticipate rather than react. To deliver constant focus in an ever-changing world. And to pursue the objectives of our clients in order to help them reach their financial goals. A proven history of helping companies and individuals. Stevens. Member NYSE SIPC.
Welcome back to this edition of From the Short Grass. Randy Reed is a volunteer with the Arkansas State Golf Association. He helps with the rules of the game during their tournaments. He helps with course setup. He helps with officiating the tournaments, and not just ASGA tournaments, but also other designated tournaments throughout the summer. Randy is a native of Fayetteville, Arkansas, graduated from the University of Arkansas, and then went off to grad school at Georgetown, which you'll hear in this interview. Now, this interview is a little bit different. It's not from a studio. It's not from a conference room. It's from the golf course, Burns Park Golf Course, between the 17th fairway and the 18th tee box. On the tee, Randy Reed.
Randy Reed, thanks for joining me on From the Short Grass. We're going to change this up a little bit. We're doing this from a golf course, and Burns Park Golf Course. It's the Arkansas State Golf Association match play going on right now, and it might be a little bit windy from time to time. You might hear the cars going down I-40 from time to time, but that's the element that you work in now, isn't it?
It often is the case, all kinds of weather, and this has been some of the hottest that I've ever worked in, as I told you earlier.
When did you first pick up a golf club? When did you fall in love with the game of golf?
I was 12 years old, and I had a friend, Grant Hall, who was eventually a golf rider in Northwest Arkansas, that took me to a boys' club junior golf clinic at the old nine-hole Razorback Park golf course in Fayetteville. And I would say, Trey, that from that day until I was about 20, I played golf every day that it was possible when I wasn't working, going to school. My parents had been big skiers, and they, when I started playing golf, I never went skiing with them again. Mm-hmm. So golf really kind of has overwhelmed me. And I think it's pretty crazy that I really can't think of anybody I know very well who isn't a golf person in some way.
Now, you didn't play. You went to the University of Arkansas. You probably played a little bit in college, I would assume. And you got your degree there, and then you decided to go off and get a master's at Georgetown?
Well, I actually was on the University of Arkansas golf team for 2 years.
Okay.
And played very unsuccessfully, to say the least. I did play Colonial a couple of times, because back then the Southwest Conference was all match play, and you played the other seven teams, which back then were all in Texas. And you had, if I remember correctly, you had a group of four players, and there were two singles matches and two four-ball matches. So that was 3 points. And at the end of the year, you added up your collection of seven matches times the number of points, and that kind of resolved the conference championship, if I remember correctly. Now, shortly thereafter, when Kite and Crenshaw were at Texas, I believe they changed to stroke play, because I remember at Paradise Valley in the early 70s, Kite and Crenshaw played there, and I'm pretty sure it was stroke play. So I kind of became a professional student after being a very unsuccessful university golfer, and then I did get a master's degree at Georgetown in the early 70s.
Your move to Georgetown and getting a master's degree up there, and you also started working when you were up there, you were telling me, at a little-known golf course called Congressional.
Well, let me say, first of all, that I had never really traveled more than 350 miles from Fayetteville, except when
Fayetteville to Fort Worth?
Except when I was really young, my mom had a sister in Los Angeles. So
okay.
The summer, I went to summer school in Los Angeles before I went to graduate school. I came back to Fayetteville for about 1 day, got some clothes, and drove to Washington, D.C. And the first place I lived was a nice block in D.C., but if you went one block to the north, it was the edge of the riot-scarred MLK riots from 1968. So it would be difficult to say how much of a cultural shock it was.
How did you decide that, okay, I want to go out and I'm be a caddy at Congressional?
I caddied for David Matthews, who older Arkansas golfers will know was a pro at Hardscrabble. And he was Wilson Matthews' son. Wilson was the right-hand man to Frank Broyles, mm-hmm. and won 10 state football titles at Central in Little Rock. And then when I came back from that in September of 73, having run out of money from a fellowship I had at Georgetown, I had to make some money. So there was an article in the Washington Post on clubs in the area that had caddies, and there were about five or six. And, of course, I knew of Congressional because Venturi had won the Open there in 64, so I went out there, and it was a busy place, only 27 holes then. But I started caddying twice every day on the weekend, and then the summers I would caddy too. So, for those who have taken caddies recently as places, in those days, in the morning I would caddy for a couple of women who would pay $7 or $8 a bag, and in the afternoon the men would pay about $10 a bag. Now some of you may know that now caddy fees are in the upper two digits or even three digits.
Yeah.
At places like Elotion or comparable places in other parts of the country. So It was a lot of money to me then, but it certainly seems paltry now.
No doubt, when you look at the evolution of the caddy as well.
Yeah, and then there was the PGA Championship there in 76, and it was interesting because Bob Benning was a great golf professional there who'd gone to Purdue and played with Nicholas and Tom Weisskopf and Ed Snead, and they came early to play practice rounds, and Bob Benning played with those three, and I got to caddy for Bob and Weisskopf in the practice round, which was a lot of fun. And about that time, Sandra Palmer, in a golf day at Congressional, she just won the Women's Open at Atlantic City Country Club, and I got to caddy for her, so I kind of got a quick indoctrination in some of the really great players.
Yeah. Take me through being a caddy at Congressional and then working your way to the Executive Golf Committee of the Maryland Golf Association.
I got married in the early 80s, and my wife didn't really play much golf, but her, as I mentioned before, I think her brother was a great player, and her dad was the president of the Maryland State Golf Association in 85. And the tradition with that organization was to try to keep some people on the executive committee from prominent clubs, because the Maryland amateur was always at the club of the president. And when my father-in-law went off in that committee in 85, he had a friend at Congressional who I also knew and had played with that he brought on, and then lo and behold, about 6 months later, the Mid-Atlantic Section PGA hired him to be their executive director, so he couldn't serve on the Maryland State Committee anymore. And one morning they walked up to me, the first tee of the golf course. We played about the same time, and they said, geez, we desperately need somebody to take this position on the executive committee. And I said, well, let me talk to my bosses. Well, I was lucky because, Trey, they were fanatical golfers. They were both members at Pine Valley. Mr. Cornell was a member at Muirfield in Scotland. He also was the only man ever to be the club champion at Congressional Chevy Chase Club in Burning Tree. So they thought this was a great idea because they thought I'd be more effective as a salesperson if I was tied to the Maryland State, and that definitely turned out to be true.
When you were on the executive committee there at the Maryland Golf Association, did that entail you helping put on tournaments, run tournaments, and then is that how you got involved with the rules of the game?
Well, compared to when I started helping Jay Fox here in Arkansas, the Maryland State at that time was kind of a funny organization in that everything was left to the golf professionals and the superintendents to set up the golf courses. Nobody ever really set up golf courses for the Maryland State that I'm aware of. Where I really learned golf course setup was doing NCAA championships in the 90s because the USGA ran them, and I'd become a USGA committee member in 1990, almost exactly the same time as Jay Fox started running Arkansas State and became a committee member. And I set up the Maryland Open in 1990, and to my knowledge, nobody else on the committee that I knew had ever done that. So that's really how I got started. But I'd benefited tremendously from working these NCAAs, including a couple with Tom Meeks, who was the longtime rules guy after P.J. Boatwright died in 1991. And so that was really helpful.
What goes in to setting up a golf course for a competition?
Five or six things. You have to decide how long to play each hole, and you may have to do that for different ages. Here this week we've got three different sets of tees. Second of all, you have to determine where the holes are going to be cut on the greens. You try to spread them around on the greens, get them in reasonable flat places if you can. Sometimes that's difficult. So today, for instance, Jay Fox did the front nine here at Burns Park, and I did the back nine. Beyond that, marking, as I mentioned earlier, penalty areas, any ground under repair. Sometimes you have dropping zones for holes where you need to play from somewhere closer to the hole than a tee on a par three, for instance. And those really are the main things. There's a few other little things, but I'd say those are the main things.
And when you get to a golf course for a competition to set it up days before the competition is set to begin, what's the first thing you like to do?
Well, the first thing that I did here, although I only had a part of the role of setup with Jay doing a lot, was I went into the golf shop. I had not been here in 50 years. And interestingly, the last time I played was with Greg Hayes, who was a quarterfinalist in the 1976 U.S. amateur and a state amateur champion, and I did not really remember anything. And Joe Ralston of the famed Ralston family here in Little Rock, first thing he said was, when I asked him, are there any greens where we really have to be careful, he said, 15, that's the one. You better be careful there.
I can attest to that.
So you need to check with a golf professional and the golf course superintendent because you got to be talking to those people. It's really, really important. And one of the reasons that, for instance, Jay Fox here knows everybody in golf in Arkansas, all golf professionals and superintendents and many general managers, and that is a big plus.
When you get out and you start setting up the course, and let's say you might find some trouble areas, what goes through your mind?
There's a lot of different kinds of trouble areas. For instance, interestingly, here at Burns on the 15th hole, which I mentioned is having a tough green, there's a tree off the back tee that really tightens the drive, and I know you know what I'm talking about because you've played it many times. Mm-hmm. So sometimes there's just not much you can do about that. It's just something that the player has to make his peace with. I used to play on a course that had a couple of trees in the middle of the fairway and just aggravated the living daylights out of me until finally I told the guy I played with all the time, hey, I finally made peace with this hole here. So that's part of the game, in my opinion, is that dealing with adversity. I felt like when I grew up and my parents didn't really play golf, never saw me hit a shot, I think it made me into a more independent person because there wasn't anybody out there helicoptering around on top of me, as happens with some of these junior parents today. So, but at any rate, there's a lot of things you can do. I mean, for instance, many people listening know that these drivable par fours have become popular largely through the influence of Mike Davis, who was USGA rules guy and executive director. Now, PJ Boatwright, who was probably the most famous rules guy and golf course setup person ever, in at least in this country, I doubt that he would ever use drivable par fours. It just wasn't something he would do. He liked to play every hole pretty similarly every day, didn't move the tees around very much, and now that's become very fashionable. So, again, you can talk to the superintendent or golf professional. They may have some ideas on how to deal with these troublesome areas that you mentioned that are – and you can end up spending 30 minutes or an hour and a half in some of these areas because they can be difficult to mark.
When you worked for the United States Golf Association in working some of their events like the U.S. Open, the Walker Cup, the USAM, the Mid-Am, the Public Links, all of those events, people from the outside that watch the U.S. Open, they want to see carnage. They want to see difficult conditions. Is that exactly what they wanted to set the course up as? They wanted to try and see, okay, even par is a good score?
Well, I think that back in the day, Joe Dye became the executive director in 1934, and they really hadn't, the organization, really, the tournaments had been run by volunteers until then, pretty much. There was a guy in the 20s, but he had a modest role. And I'm not quite sure when it reached the point that he, as many listeners know, in the 50s, when Hogan won three U.S. Opens, including at Oakland Hills in 1951, and said that he had defeated the monster because Robert Trent Jones had come in and renovated the golf course, and it was really difficult. So it was Joe Dye initially, and then P.J. Boatwright, who came on in 1960 and worked with him for 10 years before Joe Dye retired and went to PGA Tour for a few years. I think that the identity of the U.S. Open was pretty much what you said, namely, it was kind of advertised as golf's toughest test. There were amateurs at both of those golf courses that I actually worked, and some of the problems were exposed at them, particularly at Chambers Bay, because it had some really greens that were hard to keep a ball on, and so they eventually improved that for the Open that was there, I think, in 2018. 2017, I guess, when Spieth won, because everything was fescue, which was a grass that players weren't used to playing putting greens on. It could get really slick, and you couldn't keep a ball on the green. Now, since then, they've changed to bent grass there, and they pretty much remedied that problem. The problem at Erin Hills was that it was a really difficult walk between some of the greens and tees, but it was so wide that the premium that had been put on accuracy for a long time in the U.S. Open kind of went by the wayside. That really exposed the golf course to better scoring. Now, the scores were low at Chambers Bay, but it still had its difficulties, and it was such a great finish anyway, because that's where Johnson hit two great shots on 18 and then three-putted, and Spieth ended up beating by stroke. But I'd go back and say that I definitely think that there's going to be an effort to reestablish that, and you see that with the courses that they picked. They picked almost all the courses for the next 40 years. And even Los Angeles Country Club, which kind of got devastated the first round, partly because these rounds take so long to play now in a U.S. Open that you need to be a little easier the first two rounds. They're not going to finish. And I think that's a little of what happened there. But everybody knows that watched the last three rounds was really tough. The winning score didn't go much lower than the first round.
You just mentioned it, the fact that rounds have gotten so long. Have we gotten away from, Randy, the rules official coming up, putting groups on a clock, putting players on a clock to try and speed up the game?
There's a different attitude on the part of the USGA between its amateur championships and its professional championships. I would say that the pace of play problems in the U.S. amateur, given the difficulty of the courses, has been dramatically improved because they use this checkpoint system on four holes, and if you miss your time or you're more than a certain number of minutes behind the group ahead of you, you're subject to penalty. Now, you do have a chance to negotiate it, so to speak, at the scorer's table. But my experience there, Trey, was that you'd have several penalties the first stroke play round, but the second day, everybody had gotten the message, and there were no penalties. On the other side, the USGA has just never been willing to adopt that for the professionals because, quite frankly, they kind of consider them their clients. And it's not just the USGA, the PGA Tour. Of course, they rarely penalize a player's strokes. They do fine them, but we don't ever really know what exactly happened. And the other thing I would mention quickly is that the USGA's effort to speed up play with cutting the lost ball from 5 to 3 minutes and also the ready golf that they urged upon players has kind of been completely undone by, number one, the aim point on putting greens, and also this doggone alignment on the ball, because it's gotten to the point now where a lot of these players just, it's part of their pre-shot routine to line up that ball. So in my way of thinking, that's almost more than undone everything the USGA did about pace of play in 2019. They do tend to be a little bit behind the curve on dealing with these things. Some people feel that they should have done something about the clubs and balls a long time ago before it, you know, the club heads got so big and all that. These golf courses are so tough. The USGA championship courses are set up tough, and with the green speeds, players are more likely to take a lot of time around short putts.
Best championship you've ever worked?
I'd say probably Marion, the next to last Open I did in 2013, just because it was such a big step to go to such a short golf course that was and on a tiny piece of property with no infrastructure area around it. It was really quite fascinating to see. For instance, they used somebody's house for the locker room, and when you finished the round on either 18 or one other interesting thing quickly people may remember is they didn't start on 1 and 10, they start on 1 and 11.
Yes.
Because the 10th tee is so much further away from the clubhouse, that really wasn't a problem at all. But the walk from the finishing green you played to the scoring area took forever to get really off the golf course to where they had these trailers. And you see that more and more, even at the Open Championship when Harmon finished his round, it looked like it took him 20 minutes to get to scoring. Marion is just got such a great collection of holes. Did have one crazy ruling. On the second hole, which is the first of only two par fives, the other one is number four, so they're all gone after four holes. Kuchar hit a shot into the I was up ahead a little bit, and he was in one of the deep bunkers. I could not see him at all. And I heard the ball strike the club strike the ball, and I just assumed, you know, he'd advanced it on up, and I started walking. And then the caddy started yelling for me to come back, and he had hit a ball right where the sand and the thatchy area of the grass up above it on the upper edge of the bunker intersected with each other, and he could not see it.
Oh, no.
Scared to death that he was going to. So I said to them, you know, if it's up in the grass, it's a chance there'll be an embedded ball if you can find it. But if it's down in the sand, no embedded ball in the sand. So I'd kind of like to know if the ball's up in the thatchy part and you find it, are you going to, and it's embedded, are you going to play the embedded ballroom? The reason was because it would make it a little less complicated. It was less clear then about if you moved a ball during search. So anyway, they did find it, and he was able to drop up above, and I thought the ball would roll into the bunker a couple of times, but it stayed up there, and so he was able to play up. But I think, as I mentioned to you before, that's probably the wildest ruling I ever had, and the reason was because right after it happened, I got a call from Thomas Pagel, who was then the head rules guy, because they, if they have something like that happen, they want to know about it because they're desperate to find these interesting rule situations. Well, when he called me, it scared the living daylights out of me because I knew they must have had the camera on, but
yeah,
but it turned out okay.
All right, favorite golf course you've ever played? And it could be one that you've ever officiated a tournament on.
I'd say Cypress Point, but one that would be close is Yeamans Hall Club in South Carolina. And I just happen to have a friend who had a house there and probably played there 100 times. I would say that's one that most people might not know about that I would really rate high because the greens are just so interesting. I like golf courses that have interesting greens because doing golf course setup, it makes it more fun to do.
Yeah.
Other than that, I'd say that those would be two that'd be really up there. Now, Cypress Point is, I believe they've got a Walker Cup coming up. I think that's the case. But at any rate, it's not, used to be in the rotation for the Bing Crosby tournament. And I actually caddied there one time in the Bing Crosby tournament for a old football player that a few people may know, Ralph Guglielmi, who played for Notre Dame and was not particularly, I hope he didn't hear this, but was not particularly successful.
All right. Living or deceased, three other golfers that you could play a round of golf with, a fantasy foursome, if you will, who would they be?
Tom Watson is my all-time favorite because of never gets upset about anything, has had every kind of crazy problem in the world. Obviously, the 2009 Senior Open at Turnberry, where he really should have won except for the horrendous bad bounce he got off the bunker that went over the green and sink-tied him. Interestingly, there was a guy that I played with at a club I belonged to, Jack Males, who was about a 20. I've always liked some of these high index players for some reason, but he was one of the most fun guys I ever played with. Not a well-known guy, but he was very prominent at the club. And Charlie Coe would be somebody because I think he had the best single amateur performance of anybody after Bobby Jones in the 1961 Masters. He was one stroke out of tie with Gary Player, and it wasn't like these situations. He shot 69-69 on the weekend and gained five strokes on Gary Player, and man, that's just playing some golf, and he was just such a great player, and he was pretty close to where I grew up over in Oklahoma City. So I would say those three, one that nobody would know about, and then those other two.
Randy, thanks so much for your time, and I'm glad we could do this out in the heat, in the elements. Here at
Trey, you
Burns
found the
Park
only
golf course.
You found the only cool place on the property.
I was not going to be out in the middle of the sun. I guarantee you that. I tried to find some shade, and we were lucky enough to do that. But thanks for all you do for the Arkansas State Golf Association and for the game of golf.
Thank you, Trey. Take care.
With all the decisions you need to make about what to do in El Dorado, finding a place to stay is an easy one. The Haywood is uniquely positioned to make your stay one to treasure. Located in the historic Union Square District of El Dorado, the Haywood offers luxurious accommodations that feature contemporary, colorful rooms with high-quality bedding, comfortable baths with walk-in showers, and a spacious workspace with stylish plantation shutters that are unique additions to the stunning decor in a non-smoking environment. Make the Haywood your home away from home the next time you visit El Dorado.
This is Thomas Blackman with Blackman Auctions. The economy is changing slowly but surely. The market is slowing down in a gradual slide. Not an emergency yet. The sky is not falling, but a change is coming. When times are good, auctions make buyers compete to buy at the highest market value. When the economy gets tough, auctions force buyers to make a purchase decision. Either way, auctions get the highest return for a seller and a strong deal for a buyer. With an experienced auction company, it's a simple process. Go to BlackmanAuctions.com for more information. Since 1938, better auctions are Blackman Auctions.
That's all the time we have for this episode of From the Shortgrass. I want to thank Beachwood Pinnacle Hotel Group, Matthew Allen, Blair Allen. They know how to manage hotel properties. If you need an overnight place to stay, make sure you're staying at a Beachwood Pinnacle Hotel property. Remember, when you find your ball mark on the green, fix it and a couple of more. And I hope to see you sometime soon from the Shortgrass.
You've been listening to From the Shortgrass, a weekly podcast dedicated to the game of golf. This has been a presentation of the Buzz Radio Network.